From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, identitarianism, the ideology behind the white supremacist group Detroit Right Wing. One expert says they're good at playing to the media.
This appropriation of the Detroit Right Wing symbol is a very good example of this media snatching kind of strategy.
A developmentally disabled man from Flint spends nearly a year in jail before being found incompetent to stand trial.
He was very, very confused, and it was really heartbreaking to look at him and try to explain to him what's happening to him.
Teaching math through hip-hop with Mr. E and the D.
Sometimes I even have some parents come to me and say, you know what, I needed to hear that song because I was struggling with my 9 times tables and I'm learning right along with my children.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we'll look at just what happens when someone with a serious developmental disability winds up in Michigan's criminal justice system. Here's a hint, it's not pretty. But first, there were many signs and symbols on display during Saturday's white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Some of them very familiar, the Nazi swastika, the Confederate flag. And then there were marchers carrying shields and a flag with the winged wheel of the Detroit Red Wings, albeit slightly altered. The hockey club and the NHL were quick to disavow and condemn use of that logo. A hockey fan website has attributed its use to a Michigan-based group that calls itself the Detroit Right Wings. The website Russian Machine Never Breaks describes the organization as, quote, a Michigan-based group of identitarians, an anti-immigrant vein of white nationalism that counts Richard Spencer among its proponents. Just what is this vein of white supremacist ideology? With us now is Cas Muda. He's an associate professor at the School for Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, where he specializes in studying far-right extremist groups, especially those with roots in Europe. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
For many who are still trying to process what they saw Saturday, this could be the first time that they've heard that term identitarianism. Tell us about this ideology. What are its core beliefs?
Identitarian is relatively new to Europe as well, but its roots are much older. So it comes out of a movement called the New Right in France, Nouvelle Droite, which kind of modernized radical right thought and to a certain extent modernized racism. And they did this through a certain ideology they called ethno-pluralism. And in ethno-pluralism, you no longer speak so much about races, but about ethnic groups. And you don't argue that your group is better, but you argue that it's different. And as a consequence, all ethnic groups should live separated and segregated.
And when did it spread to the United States?
I've only seen it come out here, I would say, in the last 10 years. And it has been mostly used by people who are called the alt-right and who are actually mostly white supremacists, which is kind of weird because European identitarians would normally not speak in racial categories. And they would also not be supremacists. And so there is now a bit more within European circles, too, that they speak about white rather than about German or about French, as well as this perception of a threat to the white identity. And in that sense, the American and the European movement are a bit the same.
And Richard Spencer's role in spreading this ideology in the United States is what?
Well, I don't personally think that Richard Spencer is identitarian or necessarily self-identifies as such. There's a Mark Heiblich in Indiana who has used it a bit. The reason why it's so attractive and why many people take it up these days is because the identitarian movement is a little bit the same as the movement here. It is among the better educated whites. It is often young. And they are kind of shocking. They're looking for provocations that will attract media attention. And in that sense, the identitarians in Europe are very similar to the so-called alt-right in the U.S.
Cas, how are identitarians different from the Ku Klux Klan or the neo-Nazi groups that I think are pretty familiar to most Americans?
So neo-Nazis stand for an order, like a very specific order, of National Socialism and Hitler, And the Ku Klux Klan stands for kind of a very specifically American tradition of racial supremacy, slavery, Confederacy. And those are, to a certain extent, much more narrow and well-defined categories than the identitarians. Most identitarians don't consider themselves neo-Nazis. Again, don't believe that the struggle is about killing the other. It is about segregating us from them. And so their argument is not, for example, Algerians or Turks in Europe are lesser, but they shouldn't be there. And they should be in their own country, and French people shouldn't be in Turkey. Right? So it's not about the domination or the extermination of others. It is about the segregation of different ethnic groups.
But as you say, here in the United States, this issue of race has been filtered into it.
Yes, the U.S. stands out from most of Europe, perhaps except of Britain, by actually using the term race, which is not a term that is used in French or in German or in Dutch or something. And racial categories are kind of not really considered to be relevant in those countries. But in the U.S., what you see at the moment is a whole flurry of new groups, of largely also new people who are living through social media and are very oriented at attracting media attention through very specific actions in which symbolism is very important. And again, they have that in common with the identitarians, but to me, most of these movements still look very American.
Cass, as the marchers carrying the shields and the flag with the Detroit Red Wings logo were parading on the streets of Charlottesville Saturday, the video is very clear. You see them marching by, and they're chanting blood and soil. What are the historic roots of that chant?
The historic roots of that is our Nazism. Blood and soil refers to pretty much the idea that a nation, a people, are connected by blood and to the soil of their country. And so that's very clearly a neo-Nazi chant and association. I think actually this appropriation of the Detroit Red Wings symbol is a very good example of this media snatching kind of strategy. It is a very powerful symbol and known across the country. And so if you play with that, you know that you're going to get a shock effect, and that's what they like.
Is identitarianism growing in Europe?
Yes, it's growing, but it is not an electoral movement, right? It's not like Marine Le Pen or Geert Wilders or those kind of radical right politicians are not identitarians, and identitarians actually don't like these people particularly. Identitarians are mostly smaller groups of, again, higher educated young people who are involved in street politics much more than in electoral politics. So it's growing, but it's still a relatively small movement compared to the electoral successes of more established radical right parties.
And then what about here in the U.S.? How successful are their recruiting efforts here?
Well, that's very difficult to say because, as I said, in many cases, these are really established neo-Nazis or white supremacists who kind of appropriate the identitarian name or symbols but are not really that much connected to that movement. My personal reading is that there is a whole new generation, and that generation is growing, but the total numbers are really not that big. Yes, it is remarkable that, for the sake of argument, 1,000 extreme right people came together in Charlottesville, but they came from all over the country. And this is a very, very big country. So if you can only bring together 1,000 people, it shows that you're still limited. The other thing is that the U.S. has a long history of white supremacy and of white supremacist groups. And in the 1980s, you had groups like the National Alliance with a compound in Idaho, which had hundreds of people who were members. So this is not new.
What have European governments or law enforcement agencies and others done to try to curb the appeal of the racist identitarian ideology? I mean, is there anything we can learn from what's been done in Europe that we could apply here in the United States and here in Michigan?
Well, in most European countries, freedom of speech and freedom of organization and demonstration is much more limited than in the U.S. And as a consequence, a lot of meetings and demonstrations of particularly neo-Nazi groups, but even of identitarian groups, are banned. This is not possible within the U.S., given the First Amendment, and I personally think it shouldn't be. I think one of the things that we should learn is that we shouldn't get trapped in this kind of vicious circle of playing their game. What is very striking is since Charlottesville, 48 hours have gone by, and pretty much all of the people on the so-called alt-right or the identitarian scene have considered the meeting a success. Right, and Richard Spencer goes on like this. This is kind of like what we do and why we do it, and so they are all about attracting media attention, and they get disproportionate attention. It is much more through the media that they can spread their message than through their demonstrations, which generally are attended only by a couple hundred people.
So, is that your sense of the main takeaway that we should have from what happened in Charlottesville over the weekend?
Well, that, and of course, that there is a large potential for violence within the broader far right in the U.S., which has been kind of downplayed for over a decade now, particularly on the right and within Republican circles as well. And that's not just neo-Nazis, right? It's traditional racists like Dylann Roof, or it's anti-abortion activists as the shooter in Colorado, or it's the many different types of militias and anti-government organizations which are regularly involved in shootouts with law enforcement.
Cass Muda is an associate professor at the School for Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, where he specializes in studying far-right extremist groups. Thank you for spending time with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Lots more to come after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In Traverse City's East Bay, on that busy hotel strip right there on US 31, is Don's Drive-In. The pink and turquoise restaurant is known for its burgers and shakes and the fact that it's kind of old school. Here's Interlochen Public Radio's Morgan Springer.
It's old school because, for one, it has squawk boxes with menus along a row of parking spots outside. Mary Corson has arrived in her pickup truck. She's parked next to one of the boxes, checking out the menu. When she's ready, she pushes the button.
I'll be with you in just a moment.
Server Crystal Coyne heads out to take Mary's order. The Traverse City high schooler has been working at Don's Drive-In for about a month.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Okay. Are you ready to order?
Yes, I would like to have a BLT.
Okay.
And a real strawberry shake with the strawberries crushed up good.
Okay, what size?
The restaurant opened in 1958, and the staff say the menu hasn't changed much. They've added fried pickles and curly fries, mozzarella sticks.
Go.
All right, I'll get that started, okay?
Thank you much.
You're welcome.
While Mary is waiting outside, Crystal puts her order into the computer in the kitchen. The inside of Don's is about as old school as the outside. It has a checkered black and white floor, red and white booths, a jukebox, and an old pinball machine.
That's about it.
Crystal heads to the drink section to make Mary's strawberry milkshake. She puts four scoops of vanilla ice cream into a metal cup.
That looks good. So we just have like a thing of real strawberries there. And I just put a scoop in, a little bit of the juice, and that's it.
All right, the milkshake's done, and Crystal heads back outside to give it to Mary.
All right, medium strawberry for you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and your total was 12-12.
Mary says she's been coming to Don's every couple of weeks, on and off, for the past 20 years.
What do you like about it?
The good service, everybody's friendly, the old-fashioned. Yeah, it's something to blast from the past. Because they were all like this when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah, so it's just brings back good memories.
Yeah. Back inside, cook Michael Orton is working over a hot stove.
Taylor, order up, please.
He's juggling Mary's BLT order with a bunch of other orders, mostly burgers.
We've got a burger cheese, ketchup mustard, double pickles. We have one burger with ketchup mustard tomato. We have one burger.
Most of their customers get burgers.
And one burger cheese, ketchup mustard.
The burgers sizzle while Michael scoops the meat juices back onto the three that are cooking.
And there's that one.
Mary's BLT is ready to go. Crystal normally brings the food out to drivers on trays that hook to the car window and stay put while they eat. But Mary's order is to go. She takes it and drives away in her pickup, one BLT and strawberry milkshake happier. And Crystal keeps on going.
I'll be right with you.
And that story was produced by Morgan Springer of Interlochen Public Radio. He has been writing and singing about Michigan for a good many years. And tomorrow night, Michigan says thank you to Jay Steelstra. On Wednesday night, Michigan Senator Rebecca Warren will present Jay with a State of Michigan legislative tribute for his contributions in conserving Michigan's natural resources. And an all-star group of Michigan singers, musicians, and actors will be performing to honor Jay, who is with us now. Jay Steelstra, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you.
Very good to have you here. When did you start writing songs and plays?
Well, I was a football coach, but I had two little girls, and we had no piano. And so I said, I'm going to get a guitar. And so I bought one for $20, taught myself how to make a few chords. And we started singing songs together.
Like songs you'd made up?
Or well,
any, little of everything?
First off, it was a little of, you know, nursery rhymes and so on. And then, you know, the girls eventually grew up. And back in the 70s, I had a few songs that I'd written. I decided I would begin to perform them in public. And so I went to that open mic thing at the Arc up on Hill Street. And kind of sucked it up and went in and sang a song, and apparently people liked it.
So how often do you perform now?
It seems that it comes about once a month. I performed up north frequently, and so it's just kind of loose. I've been very fortunate in that I've had people, very, very good people, that are willing to play with me.
Yeah. What would you say is the biggest thrust of the songs you write? What are you most interested in exploring?
I think one thing that I have done is I've promoted liberal views on the environment, on politics. I've written a number of songs against the United States involvement in various unsatisfactory wars. Some songs, they just evolve on their own. The song The Manistee Waltz, for instance, a friend died who I had fished with on the Manistee River. And after his death, I wrote The Manistee Waltz.
Well, let's take a listen to some of that beautiful song, Manistee River Waltz, right now.
Will the Manistee River give us a nod to tell us that she surely knows we're weaker and fewer this year by one, and trying to not let it show. The Manistee River runs through the ward, and the Manistee runs through Sharon.
It had to be healing to write a song about the loss of your friend and put it into such beautiful words and music.
I don't know, you know. It all happened quite a long time ago. But the song seems to have endured.
You're being honored tomorrow night, Jay, for particularly your environmental consciousness in your music. What's the message you want to get across in respect to the environment and Michigan's natural resources?
I think the main thing is that we have to give up on all trying to be wealthy. And instead, we have to protect the place we live and be satisfied with less than great riches. It seems like there's been so much emphasis on making money, and they don't say that, but they say, well, it provides jobs, or it does this, it does that, but it has destroyed the environment. I oppose that.
You are also a playwright, and a lot of attention has been paid to the one-man show that you wrote and performed called Old Man in Love. What's that about?
Well, I first performed it a long time ago when I wasn't an old man. And I used to have to put powder in my hair and so on.
Funny how that happens, isn't it? It kind of sneaks up on you.
But it's just an old man reviewing his life and how he feels about things.
Would you perform a small passage for us?
Yes, I would.
Please.
Ah, it was a grand life I had. Just one big love affair. But you know, as I get older, the great loves of my life, they all seem to run together, and sometimes I can't tell who's who or what's what. So if I confuse you tonight, well, don't worry about it, because I don't, not even while I'm telling you about them. You see, I figure a person's got so much love to give, and you can use it up about any way you want. Some spend it on money, fame, or things, boats, cars, musical instruments. I spent mine on women and the country of the Great Lakes. And it's a damn good thing I did, too. If I spent it on fame and fortune, I'd be long gone by now. Besides, I think it's good for a man to love a place. For some, it's the desert, the ocean shore, the mountains. For me, it was always the woods and waters of the Great Lakes country. So tonight, I want to tell you what it's like to be an old, old man and still in love. Well, I'm not so old, really, not like one of my loves. She is old. She's older than God. Now I ask you, is that possible? Was there God before there was people, or did people invent God? I'd like to know about that. Maybe not right now, though. Where the hell was I anyway? Oh yeah, my old love. Well, about 12,000 years ago, I told you she was old. When the glacier finally let her go, I used to say he might come back for her, but the way things are heating up, that seems kind of doubtful. Anyway, when the glacier let her go, he left her with a grand glory, a halo of sorts that we call the Great Lakes.
That is singer, songwriter, playwright, poet Jay Steelstra performing a portion of his one-man show, Old Man in Love. How do you see yourself and the writings you do and the songs you write and perform? What do you see?
I don't know, really. It's hard to look at yourself. I've done what I've done, and I just felt compelled to do it, I guess. And I've been very fortunate. As I said, I've had encouragement and recognition and gigs. What more could I ask? That's all anyone could ask for.
We should also note that tomorrow at the event at the Arc, Jay's latest CD, Heaven for Me, will be released. And again, Michigan is such a centerpiece of what you care about and what you write about and what you sing about.
Well, thank you.
Jay Steelstra, congratulations from all of us here at Stateside, and thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's guest on The Next Idea is an educator who aims to take schoolhouse rock right into the 21st century. Stateside's Lester Graham has this story.
Mr. E in the D. Mr. E and the D is Emmanuel Smith. He's the Dean of Culture at University Prep Ellen Thompson Elementary, a charter school in Detroit. If you're old enough, you might remember Schoolhouse Rock. Well, Mr. E is updating that with hip hop for math. This one is learning to count by five.
Five, five, 10, 10, 15, 15, 20, 20, 25, 25.
Mr. E joins us now. I'm told you describe yourself as being inspired by old school PBS. What do you mean by that?
The Sesame Streets, the Mr. Rogers, the Polka Dot Doors, all of those shows, the Electronic Connection, they really have a special place in my heart. It opened up my imagination. And most of all, they used a lot of imagination and music, and it just really stuck with me down through the years.
Obviously, this math mixtape is aimed toward the elementary school crowd, but you know, parents are going to be within earshot of this, too. How much was that a consideration when you wrote and recorded the Math Mixtape Volume 1?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have four kids myself. So a lot of times listening to some of their music, you know, it's okay for a while. But after a little bit, you know, I can take so much. So what I did was I take the music that, you know, families are listening to, popular culture is listening to, and change up the lyrics so that mom and dad, they're already listening to that song per se. And I just change up the lyrics so that, you know, mom and dad love to listen to it too. And sometimes I even have some parents come to me and say, you know what, I needed to hear that song because I was struggling with my nine times tables and I'm learning right along with my children.
Yeah, a little head bopping going on at the same time.
Yes, sir.
This mixtape helps a lot with multiplication tables. So yes. Let's listen to a bit of Multiples of Sevens on My Mind.
Let's go, listen. 7, 14, 21. Hashtag I'm winning, better yet, I won. 28, 35. I'm so turned up when I multiply. 42, 49. You can't do it, YCDI. 56, 63. Mr. E and the D's really helping me.
So that certainly beats flashcards. I mean, when you're singing about multiples of a number, I would think it would get easy to get into a rut. What inspires you to find the right music for the right number?
You know, it's almost like the music kind of calls out to me. But like I said before, I just pick music that's playing on the radio that has a nice groove to it. And also, as you just heard in Sevens on My Mind, just to build the morale for education where I'm a winner and I know I'm going to win again, you know, because a lot of times our kids, they're kind of intimidated by math. So I want to have them from the onset, just like math, I love it, and I'm going to conquer whatever problems put in my way.
Where can people hear some more of your songs?
You can go to MrEandTheD.com.
You called this the Math Mixtape Volume 1, which suggests there might be future math mixtapes. What are your plans for other subjects, such as language skills?
I'm working on my next mixtape as we speak. It's entitled Letter Sounds and Sight Words. I'm very excited about this one because it gives students the tools that they need at the beginning, going towards reading, just the sight words. A lot of times, some parents think that, you know, when they go into kindergarten, that they know the ABC songs where they're set. Well, we're going to do the letters, the sounds, and those 100 sight words that are needed for young readers. And we're going to come out with a lot of visuals for those songs, too, so they can be utilized in the classrooms and on smartphones and all that good stuff.
That is Emmanuel Smith, a.k.a. Mr. E and the D. Thanks for sharing with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's go out with Multiples of Four. So cool.
4, 8, 8, 12, 16. It's easy as pie. Know what I mean? 20, 24, 28, 32, 36. That's great. 40, 44, 48. That's 12 times 4.
Count them. Yeah, two rings.
I have to answer the phone there.
No, I am counting the rings. Three rings.
I'll get it.
Oh, you tricky Ernie. Four rings.
But I have to answer
five.
Hello? Hello?
Five glorious springs!
That, of course, a bit of classic Sesame Street featuring the Count and Ernie.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What happens to someone when they're found mentally incompetent to stand trial in Michigan? One Flint man's story offers us some clues. Justin Lee Dawson is severely developmentally disabled. Although Dawson's 28 years old, his family says he has the IQ of a six-year-old child. After Genesee County prosecutors charged him with felony criminal sexual conduct in January of 2016, Dawson spent nearly a year in the county jail before being moved to a state psychiatric facility. And that long wait, along with what's happened since then, has left Justin's family and his court-appointed attorney angry and frustrated. With us now is Justin Dawson's sister, Tashara, and his former defense attorney, Michael Ewing. Michael, we ought to start out by making it very clear. You're Justin's former attorney because the case has been dismissed, but you're still advocating for him and trying to speak out for him. Why are you still involved in this case?
When I met Justin, and I was appointed to handle his case, and I was speaking to him about the charges and the courts and what was going on, I could see in his eyes this innocent kid, and I mean innocent at heart kid, who really did not understand what was happening. He had no idea what the courts were doing. He didn't understand what the role of the prosecutor was. He was very, very confused. And it was really heartbreaking to look at him and try to explain to him what's happening to him when he doesn't understand.
Michael, how long has Justin been held either in jail or in the state psychiatric hospital?
It was early 2016 when he was charged. And I told the judge that he doesn't understand the nature of the charges, he doesn't understand the role of the parties, and that he needs to be reviewed pursuant to the statute. And I will say that back then, the center was a lot slower about doing these reviews. They are much quicker now than they used to be. But he sat there for almost a year before that determination was made. But of course, under the statute, they can keep him for up to 15 months before finding him competent or incompetent to stand trial.
Tashara, Justin is your younger brother. He's in his 20s, isn't he?
Yes.
Tell us about him. What is he like?
He's a trip. He's funny. He's caring. He loves everybody. He's a good kid all around. He was a good kid in school. He was a good kid at home. Loves video games. Loves movies. He's a good kid all around.
Now, has Justin been diagnosed, Tashara, with a specific condition?
Yeah, he was diagnosed with actually a couple of different things. The first thing that he was diagnosed with was back then in the olden days, so to say, was mental retardation, was the word that they used for it. Now, I don't know what they would call it now, but that's what it was back then. He was diagnosed with that, bipolar, ADHD, ADD, and a couple other things.
What's his mental capacity? I mean, have the doctors given you like a definite mental capacity?
I'm almost 30, and my brother's brain, he's 28. So his brain, the doctors would say, would be working at like age 6 or age 7.
Can you tell us, Tashara, your understanding of just what happened, of the circumstances that got your brother into this legal trouble?
That's rough. It's actually my daughter. Technically, she's my niece. I adopted her from mine and Justin's younger brother, Eugene. He's really bad into drugs and alcohol, and we didn't want her to go to the state, so I adopted her. Well, I got guardianship of her. And she's the victim in the situation, and that's how it all came about.
And can you tell us, as far as how did you learn about this, and what was it that supposedly that she said happened?
She came into the bedroom, into my wife's bedroom, And she calls me Sissy, and she calls my wife Mommy. And she said, Sissy, Mommy, Uncle Justin touched me. So what do you mean Uncle Justin touched you? She said, Uncle Justin touched my vagina. I initially went insane. I let my biological father know. He said, well, it will be taken care of. I said, and in his eyes, being taken care of was move Justin out into the backyard in a camper.
Okay.
So that's how it was taken care of in his eyes. I wanted my brother to get some help. He needed help. He's been needing help. He's not on the proper medication. He's not on any medication at all. Mm. He had no therapist to talk to. He had nothing. So there was no help for him. So my wife and I, we spoke with Isabel's therapist about it, not even putting two and two together that she's a mandated reporter. She's going to have to report that to CPS. And that's what ended up happening. CPS got involved. They ended up contacting the police. Police came out, arrested my brother.
And just for our listeners, CPS is Child Protective Services. Tashara, had Justin ever done anything like this before with your daughter or any other child?
No, never. He's never done anything like this before. It was a complete shock to all of us.
So what I think I'm hearing you say is you wanted him to get help. This arrest was not something you wanted to see happen.
No, we didn't want him arrested. We didn't want him in jail. No, absolutely not. And I tried to tell the prosecutor that as well, and she wouldn't listen to anything I had to say. She was like, well, if you're not pressing charges, the state of Michigan will press charges. No, that's not what we wanted. We just wanted him to get some help. Like, that's it. All of this that happened was blown way past what needed to be.
Michael, the Genesee County Prosecutor's Office charged Justin with criminal sexual conduct, and you were appointed to represent him. And you made it very clear you didn't think he was fit to stand trial. So how did you proceed?
Well, the statute says that in this situation, you have to raise the issue with the court and tell the court that he needs to be reviewed to check whether he is, in fact, competent to stand trial or not. And so that's what I did, and the court, of course, sent him to the Center for Forensic Psychology, where they did that review.
But he spent the better part of a year in the Genesee County Jail.
Yes. So there were several delays in getting him there. At one point in time, the sheriff indicated that they didn't have enough deputies to take him there. He had another appointment, and they indicated that they had just forgot to take him there. But some of that was also the center's issue, where they were taking a really long time to interview people. That, probably this year, has really been reduced significantly. They are getting people in for review much quicker than they did last year and in the years previous.
And you've said the law says this has to happen, you said, within 15 months?
Yes. So here's the other thing that's kind of silly with regard to Justin's situation. So here's sort of how it works. If you are found incompetent to stand trial, then what the state does is try to use medication and education in order to help make you competent to stand trial. That's how it works. And so somebody who might be have some sort of psychological issue that can be treated with medication, that might work. But Justin's IQ is close to 50. And there's not anything that you can do with medication, I don't think. I'm not an expert, but I don't think that there's a medication that's going to be able to make him competent to stand trial. So there was a period of time where they were holding him to try and educate him and medicate him. And then they finally said, this isn't going to work. They come to the conclusion that we had come to much earlier than that, that you can't medicate and educate him to make him competent.
Now, my understanding is it took until February 7th for a judge to ultimately dismiss Justin's case after the determination of competency happened. And if the charges were dropped and his family wanted him home, why didn't that happen, Michael? Why was he sent to Kalamazoo Psychiatric Hospital instead?
Because that's what the statute calls for.
Mm.
The statute indicates that once the charges are dismissed, they are then referred to the probate court, and the probate court takes over.
So the purpose of going to the hospital is what? To live out his days? Is there who determines how long he stays?
I think there are a couple of questions. The reason that ultimately he sent for the forensic review is because a defendant cannot plead guilty to a charge or even no contest to a charge or even a reduced charge if they don't understand what they are doing. So here's the kicker, I guess, in this. The prosecutor had made an offer to Justin where he could plead guilty to a reduced charge and they would agree to have him released back to his family.
Okay.
But the statute says, and the law, not just the statute, but the court rule indicates, a person who doesn't know or understand what a guilty plea or a no contest plea is cannot plead guilty or no contest. A judge cannot accept their plea.
This sounds like a complete catch-22.
Well, it is. But I guess the principle behind it is noble, right? You don't want people pleading guilty or no contest who don't understand what they're doing. So, you know, we get that. But at the same time, you know, as I'm talking to him, I know that there's no judge that would accept his plea because he doesn't understand. And I can't ethically expect him to plead guilty or no contest when he doesn't understand what that means or what that does. That puts him on a sex offender registry and all the other things. Mm. Could be future imprisonment if there are issues while on probation and so on. Now, in terms of going to the Center for Forensic Psychology, that, of course, is governed by the statute. I contacted the center earlier in the year to find out what would happen to him. They reported to me that they would interview him, find out what level of care he needed, and then place him in a facility where he would get the care that he needed. It could be an inpatient situation if it were severe and serious. It could be an outpatient thing. It could be an assisted living kind of situation, which is what we were hoping for. But he needed help. And so it sounded like it might have been a good thing in the end because he would get the help that he needed, medication and housing mainly.
Tashara, when's the last time you saw Justin?
We went and seen him in, it was either February or March. And we had a meeting with the doctors and with Justin's case manager. Her name is Rose.
Uh-huh.
And that meeting didn't go as planned.
Why is that?
Well, we went there. I told all of the doctors, you guys have no reason to be holding my brother. The charges have been dismissed. He should be able to go home with us today. And apparently they didn't like what I had to say. And I was kicked out of the room. So it was just my grandma and my grandpa in the room. And I don't know what went on in there, but it wasn't good because my grandma left quite mad and my brother had to go back to his room. I couldn't even tell him bye. And I have not been allowed to talk to him on the phone ever since.
One of the things you said earlier was that you wanted your brother to get some help. Well, he's at a psychiatric hospital now. Is he getting help? Is he getting medication? Do you think there's any good that can come from this hospital stay for him?
He is, as far the last I knew, he was on his medication. I assume that he is still on medication being there. My grandma gets to talk to him. I don't. I'm not allowed to. So from what I'm told, she said he sounds like he's doing really good. I asked my grandma, you know, how much longer is he going to be there, you know, or be brought before he can be brought home? If he's doing good, then why can't he be moved closer to home to where we can see him and where we can get to him? You know what I'm saying? Like, be there.
You know, Tashara, there are people who will listen to this story and have a hard time understanding why you really want your brother to come home again when something inappropriate happened with your little girl. How do you answer that? What do you say?
Ooh, that's rough. most parents would be like, nope, keep him where he's at. But he didn't know what he's doing. It wasn't his fault. There was no penetration. It was on the outside of the clothes where he touched her. And if he would have been seeing someone and been getting help before, it wouldn't have happened. I don't know how to try. He doesn't need to be where he's at. And I'm being on the parent side of it. I'm kind of stuck between a rock and a hard spot, but that's my brother, and he didn't know any better. And if he would have known, it wouldn't have happened. It wasn't his fault.
Michael, what does Justin's case tell us about the way the system handles defendants who have a severe mental disability?
The first, thing it tells us mistakenly is that if you have somebody who is severely mentally handicapped, that if we think that we are going to medicate them and educate them to make them competent to stand trial, it's not realistic. That was the biggest thing that really was a shock to me, was when we got that report and it said, well, we're going to work with him to try and make him competent. He has an IQ of 50. They're not going to give him a medication that's going to make him competent. And I was really taken back by that. I said, wow, this is really kind of a surprise.
What are your final hopes for this young man?
I hope that he gets to see his family. He's not a bad kid. He doesn't understand. That's the thing that really just really got me about this whole thing. He doesn't understand. An IQ near 50 is basically a child. And maybe the treatment that, you know, he's receiving should have been more like how we would have handled a young child doing this, where we would have said no, would have explained why, instead of the route that he's had to go through. If you talked to him face to face, you looked into his eyes, you would see that there's not a mean bone in this kid's body. There's not a shred of evil in him. And he's really sort of caught in this situation where there's not much that we can do to help from the outside. But I'm not sure that how much help is being done on the inside. We just don't know.
Attorney Michael Ewing and Tashara Dawson, we want to thank you both so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One additional note. According to a billing statement the family received from the Kalamazoo Psychiatric Hospital and shared with Stateside, during a one-year period from May 1st, 2016 to April 30th of this year, the cost to taxpayers for Justin Lee Dawson's care totaled $318,966.57. Coming up tomorrow, we'll review Dawson's case and talk about how Michigan courts can improve when it comes to dealing with people who have mental health issues with Milton Mack, the current state court administrator and former Wayne County judge.
The way the system failed Justin is the way the system is failing people across America.
That's tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.